Chapter 8. Mental vertigo, do you have it? It was an unfortunate accident that caught the entire country off guard. Three young, attractive, well-known people, JFK Jr., his wife, and her sister died in a plane crash. After studying the crash, FAA investigators determined that the cause of the accident was the pilot's failure to maintain orientation. Additionally, they concluded that the disorientation was strongly influenced by marginal weather. JFK Jr. got into what pilots refer to as vertigo. Maybe you've heard of vertigo. Psychologists use the term to describe dizziness or disorientation. In flying, it means something else. It's not necessarily dizziness, though that may be involved, but it is any disorientation caused by environmental factors which cause you to believe that the attitude of your plane is something other than what it truly is. It's usually deadly when you make decisions based on your senses, like vision, balance, etc., which provide incorrect or inadequate information. Studies show that an inexperienced pilot will crash within 3 minutes if flown into certain marginal weather situations for which they have not been trained. In aviation, there are various training levels or certifications you can achieve. Initially, someone will start taking lessons to get their PPL, Private Pilot's License. This is a great start into aviation, though there are many other paths people could choose to enter aviation. Next, many new pilots purchase or rent a plane and are allowed to fly to another state or even another country. With respect to the basic PPL, perhaps the biggest restriction that's associated with this certification is the various weather conditions in which they are permitted to fly. The law states that PPL holders must stay clear of clouds or storms, and in most cases they need at least 3 miles of visibility so that they can see where they're going. A pilot with a private rating flies VFR. VFR stands for Visual Flight Rules. That's why the limitation is placed on them to only fly in good weather and when visibility is good. Their ability to navigate in a manner that relies heavily on visual clues means that if they fly in a cloud, they not only can't see, they are breaking the law. When a VFR pilot flies in marginal weather, they have to be very aware of developing conditions and the distance to visual impairments in order to continue to fly both legally and safely. The danger lies in inexperienced pilots trying to push the limits of their experience and training and when they enter marginal or low visibility situations. While you may think it's obvious why this is so dangerous, but consider this. Without any visual reference, the only way you can know where you're going and what the airplane is doing is to rely completely on the instruments in the cockpit. Without proper training, practically everyone will begin to ignore the instruments and fly by their feelings. If you've ever flown even as a passenger on a large jet, you know that clouds frequently make for a bumpy ride. Small planes experience the same rough ride through clouds. As you bounce around in the airplane, the fluid in your inner ear begins to move, which in turn cause spatial disorientation. Up may become down, left might feel like right, and so on. Try as you might, it is simply impossible to use the senses you normally would depend on to accurately judge your orientation if you enter a turbulent airstream with limited or zero visibility. Unfortunately, to this day, pilots still crash because they get into mental vertigo. Often a pilot who is not properly trained or rated will depart in marginal weather, and as they're flying, the weather starts to deteriorate. Instead of landing or turning back, they push it and keep going. They get socked in. Because they haven't had sufficient training or experience flying by instruments alone, they end up flying into a mountain or crashing nose first while believing they were in straight and level flight. Life is often like this. One moment we feel sure about our success, and the next moment that feeling of success we had just a day ago or even 5 minutes ago is no longer there. Although I speak to seminar audiences regularly, the topics aren't always the same. Sometimes I have an opportunity to include an explanation of mental vertigo as part of my program. To make my illustration more powerful, I ask the audience to hold their right arm straight out in front of them with their hand flat and palm facing the ground to represent an airplane in straight and level flight. Next, I have them point the thumb of their right hand to the 7 o'clock position to represent a smooth banking turn to the left. I ask them to keep their palm in this left turn position for a minute as I continue the explanation. I say, Imagine that you're flying along and all of a sudden you get caught in bad weather. The plane shakes and clouds obscure your vision. Remember, don't move your hand from the left banking turn. I continue, now imagine that you've been bounced around for a few minutes and you still don't have visual clues to help you reorientate yourself. If your feelings told you that you were banking to the right and you look at your hand, you're still banking left. So if your feelings told you that you were banking right and you wanted to correct the plane to establish a left bank in order to fly level, what would that mean? As I have the audience move their hand to indicate a further left turn, many of them even lean left as the tops of their outstretched hands start facing the ground and their palms begin turning upward. The original left bank that you had initiated, coupled with your feelings that you were banking to the right as a result of mental vertigo, has caused you to roll to the left even further. Now you're upside down and you are totally out of control. That's the deadly reality of vertigo. At this point, people who don't have any experience flying, or even some VFR pilots, ask, why don't you just fly by the instruments? That should be easy. The instruments tell you exactly what to do. Though this is very true, an untrained person, no matter how smart or quick they are, will not make it. Your feelings have guided you all your life, and the drive to obey your feelings is stronger than your logical mind's ability to reason through the situation and use the instruments. As a VFR-rated pilot with little or no exposure to instrument flying, that is exactly what happened to JFK Jr. A number of lessons can be learned here. First is the difference between flying by your feelings and flying by your instruments. The more risk you take in business and in life, the more susceptible you will be to mental vertigo. Taking risks and pushing past your own personal comfort zone can cause a rough ride, and that's the beginning of mental vertigo. So if we don't learn to master mental vertigo, we'll tailspin and crash. There's even more to instrument flying than you might imagine. By law, your instruments must be calibrated at regular intervals. Imagine flying in bad weather and you have a plane with a full complement of instruments. You've been trained to fly by your instruments, so you're ready to go. What if you haven't kept them calibrated? This is sure to spell disaster. Instrument training is only part of the picture, because if some of your instruments are off just a few degrees, it could mean the difference between landing on a runway and crashing into a mountain, a radio tower, or a building. Another thing a private pilot must do before permitted to fly in bad weather or clouds is that they must get enough additional training to earn an additional certification. The next license for many pilots is to attain their instrument rating. That way they can fly IFR, instrument flight rules. For a pilot to go from a private pilot's license to an instrument rating license, they must spend a minimum of approximately 40 additional hours practicing instrument-only flying with a qualified instrument instructor. The majority of the training actually consists of actually flying in good weather, but you pretend that you're flying in zero visibility weather. They do this by making the student wear a hood or foggles, fog simulating goggles. You put the hood on like a hat, but the hood protrudes from the side about 8 inches or so and is curved on the left and right side so that you can't see outside of the cockpit. It's like flying with blinders on because you can only see the instruments on the panel in front of you. It also blocks the view through the windshield so you can't see outside at all. This is called simulated instrument training because external conditions don't require instrument use. This kind of instrument flying makes up most of the logged hours pilots use toward qualifying a pilot for an instrument rating. After he or she meets the hourly qualifications and is proficient in specific maneuvers, the candidate takes a check ride with an FAA examiner who confirms the candidate's ability to meet prescribed standards. If the pilot has logged sufficient hours with a certified instructor and passes the check ride, they get their IFR rating, and they're allowed to fly through clouds and in most bad weather. In life and business, if we are not properly trained and prepared for the hard times, the challenging times will cause us to go into mental vertigo and we'll be in trouble. Trust me, troubled times will come. the more experience you gain in dealing with these problems or challenges, the more you can handle them, and the better equipped you'll be to handle additional challenges in the future. I'd like to give you a preview of what you'll be doing later in order to identify your instruments, calibrate them, and begin to fly by them. First, you will identify what your beliefs are. You need to determine if your beliefs will get you your desired results and if they're keeping you back or even causing you problems. Do your beliefs help you or your company or both? Or are your beliefs putting you or your company in danger? You'll also need to understand how to calibrate your beliefs or instruments, and you don't just set them and forget them. You need to have a regular schedule of training and calibration to keep you and your equipment in top form. For example, as an instrument pilot, I am required by law to execute a specific amount of approaches, simulated or real. An approach is basically a pilot's method for flying into a landing pad into an airport without seeing it from a distance. You must rely strictly on your instruments to get to the airport. Every 6 months, the FAA wants you to make sure you're on top of your game by logging several instrument approaches. If you go beyond the 6-month limit, you must fly with an instructor to practice these approaches. These strict guidelines even apply to a pilot like me who has been flying for years. Now, when you consider the effects of vertigo and the training necessary to teach someone to ignore their feelings and obey their instruments, it might sound like the FAA has appropriately strict guidelines in place. Here is something that is very interesting, though. Do you realize that many, if not most, pilots who pass their instrument check ride, who are legal to fly in the clouds and take you up with them, have never actually flown through a cloud? Did you know that most have little or no experience actually flying in weather where you have to solely rely on the instruments? There is something even scarier. The flight instructor that trained the new IFR pilot may not have been through that kind of real-world experience either. That's right. Many people become flight instructors because it helps them build more flying hours, which is a requirement to get hired by major airlines. Students pay them while they build time. If they do have some actual experience flying in instruments-only weather, it's unusual to find somebody who has as much as 10 or 20 hours doing it. You can actually get your instrument rating and then move on to becoming an instrument-rated flight instructor. Give other pilots, your students, the necessary training and instruction so they can pass their instrument check ride and do this for years while never actually experiencing instrument flying conditions. This is all totally legal. Now, I didn't tell you all this to make you afraid to fly. Most commercial pilots have more hours in clouds than pilots with an IFR rating have in airplanes. The point here is that credentials are one thing, experience is another. I'd like you to consider one more thing. I don't intend to suggest that all people who are flight instructors without in-cloud experience are bad teachers. But wouldn't you think that the ones with more zero visibility flying under their belt would generally make better instructors? If that's true, it may help to remember that I have navigated through some of the roughest storms life can throw at you, and what I tell you is based on what I've learned about instrument flying from having been there. If something I tell you doesn't sound like what you've heard from a PhD, that might just be because my examples and tools come from in-cloud time and not a textbook. With flight ratings, the good thing is that most FAA examiners understand that the rating doesn't mean the pilot is experienced. As a result, many examiners will give new IFR pilots a stern warning about using their new rating slowly. The best approach is to take time and gain experience in marginal conditions instead of pushing the limits of your new earned certification. You fly, you learn. You fly more, you learn more. You build up your confidence and you determine what your limitations are and you stay within them until you build more experience and so on. A seasoned pilot will begin to rely more on his instruments and less on his feelings. When a pilot feels or experiences vertigo but totally ignores his feelings and flies strictly by what his instruments tell him, you can still fly by instruments at the present not feel or be in vertigo, has mastered vertigo. It's inevitable that in life we're going to experience mental vertigo. We just get that feeling at times that we can't figure out up from down and left from right. What should we do when that happens? Well, what does a pilot do? They immediately fly by their instruments. You must do the same. Keep in mind, the time to identify your beliefs and try to fly by them is not while you're in the clouds or bad weather. Consider this book as flight training for life to assist you in flying by your own beliefs or instruments and to make sure they are properly calibrated. In Chapter 8, we covered, people move forward based on their interpretation of where they think they are right now. If where you think you are is different from reality, you may be headed in the wrong direction altogether. Pilots learn to fly by their instruments and ignore their feelings. With proper training, you can do this in business and life too. When things get hectic personally or professionally, your feelings can put you in a tailspin. But if you're trained to pay attention to your beliefs, they can act as your instruments to guide you through the tough times. You must learn how to fly by your beliefs before you enter the storm. This concludes Chapter 8. Chapter 9. Beware of the marathon runner who smiles. Success hurts, usually not in the end, but along the way. The journey to your goal will almost always have a measure of painful experiences. The truth is, life is tough. Life's not fair. Achievement can be a battle. Self-help books and experts who tell you that the act of setting a goal will put you on autopilot towards success are oversimplifying. This isn't another one of those feel-good books that just glosses over the tough times. This book is about triumph in spite of the tough times and being able to move ahead and not let other people or other things rent space in your head. People lose credibility when they tell you success and reaching your goals is easy when it's not. Great achievement is inevitably the result of dealing with great challenges, and people get discouraged when they look to role models who have achieved success and who seem to be living the good life. So many times people think it's not supposed to be this hard. They're wrong. I've worked with thousands of people who want to be more successful or overcome some major life challenges, and frequently they have one or more of the following beliefs. Unfortunately, these beliefs are suggested as a simple formula for success or an excuse for not achieving it. But each one is an outrageous lie that is simply worthless. These beliefs won't serve you, and they almost always lead to failure. Successful people are all lucky. Dreams can come true if you believe in them. Just set a goal and it will happen. Positive thinking solves problems. I just don't have what it takes. I'm not old enough yet, or I'm too old. It takes too much money to do what I want. I'm realistic. Big success will never happen for me. I'm not talented enough. I don't feel I have any free time to do that. You have to know the right people, and I don't have any connections. I can't find any mentors. I'm too fat. I had a bad childhood. My parents were alcoholics. I just can't get motivated. I'm not good at business. I had a bad divorce. Every one of these statements is an excuse to avoid even trying. I can't control my eating, emotions, drinking, etc. My mind doesn't work that way. I don't have that type of personality. I'm too tired. There aren't any jobs. I've already tried everything. Nothing I do works anyway. Why bother? It's just not meant to be. I wouldn't even know where to start. I'm not that lucky. It would take too much time. I already work hard enough as it is. Nobody understands me. I can't do it by myself. I need a whole team to make that happen. I'm afraid of failing. I don't have the Midas touch. Running a marathon is easy. Just smile through the pain. What a crock. These are a bunch of out-and-out lies we tell ourselves. Every one of these statements is an excuse to avoid even trying. I bet you could write a chapter for every one of these excuses people use, why they're wrong, and what the real truth is. I'm confident the audience reading this book is emotionally mature enough to see the holes in each of these absurd excuses, so I won't bore you with the reasons why each excuse is a waste of your time. I speak from experience when I say success is great. Reaching big goals is incredible. Success is worth the effort, but success is not painless, and it's never easy all along the way. Part of what makes success so rewarding is the struggle to reach your goals. Reaching a business or personal goal is rewarding because of the limited number of people who can achieve at that level. Most people just get caught up in the drudgery of daily life or bogged down by their own crummy, excuse-ridden beliefs. And then their limiting beliefs about their own handicaps to success are reinforced by the media's portrayal of successful people. Smiling, jet-setting, luxury lifestyles with no hint of struggles to look to get to the good life or what it takes to maintain a level of success. I produced a CD series entitled Secrets That My Millionaire Mentors Taught Me About Business and Success. The series is full of interviews with amazingly successful people, some making hundreds of millions and others billions annually. My goal is to avoid pulling punches and just show the stereotypical infomercial view of success. As you listen to them speak from the heart and from the gut, you'll hear about the hard times along the way because it's reality. Granted, most of us haven't run a 26.2-mile marathon, but this chapter will still make sense. Those who have run a marathon certainly have learned a tremendous amount about themselves and the mind games that they play with themselves while making their run. Even if you don't know anyone personally who has run a marathon, I'm sure you know that no one ever wakes up and says, "I hear there's a marathon next week, I'm going to enter it." Preparing for a marathon takes months of physical and mental conditioning. Someone might start off with running a mile or two, if they can make it that far. Then they have to let their body heal and adjust to the exercise regimen, especially if they're new to running. After some time, they work up to 5 and 10 and 20 miles. Anytime I've ever watched a marathon, I don't recall the runners having happy, big grins on their faces and chanting trite positive affirmations. In fact, immediately after the finish line, lots of runners collapse. I even remember seeing runners literally crawl to the finish line in tears. You just have to admire the fact that they finished. They crossed the finish line. That was their goal, and they made it. We must remember that sometimes it can be very painful to even try to cross our personal finish line. That is why we have to focus on the end at the beginning and develop our plan for getting there. We always have a choice to keep running or quit. I remember a time in my young life when I didn't have enough money to buy groceries. That's a really humbling experience. That didn't bring a smile to my face, nor did I want someone to tell me to just smile or think positive. In spite of all the hardships along the way and the temptation to quit, I kept running. During the really tough times, it may be impossible to put on a smile and look at the bright side of things. Regardless, if you have a plan to reach your goal, you've got to keep moving. Even if you're moving slow, you're still moving. I often hear people say, "Just smile." This usually tells me that they aren't in touch with my destination or my current struggles. Would a seasoned marathon runner who is running alongside you at the 17th mile when you're thinking about quitting say, "Smile, it's not that bad"? No way. He or she would probably tell you, "Keep going and don't give up. Things are tough, that's true. Stay focused. Stick to your plan. Remember, the finish line is your goal." And the seasoned runner wouldn't be smiling either. If there's a self-proclaimed marathon runner in your life who tells you to smile while you're in pain, he probably hasn't run many marathons, if any. Oh, it would be nice to smile all the time, but it isn't reality. Big goals yield big challenges, and sometimes smiling just wastes your energy and makes you lose sight of your plan and your finish line. When you're in the thick of a battle, it may be all you can do to simply focus on your plan. And don't think that the little "life isn't fair, there will be struggles, get a grip, this is reality" chapter is an excuse to be rude or harsh or grumpy whenever you're working on your goals. It's not. You need to be nice to everybody, especially on the playground. It's just that during times of true struggle, it's not practical to try to smile all the time. The tool you can use to keep going through rough times is to make sure you work your plan. The marathon runner, though feeling pain and exhaustion at times throughout the race, still puts one foot in front of another. That's their plan. That really is the key. The goal is the finish line, and the plan is one foot in front of the other. Focus on the plan, not the pain. What's your plan? Every goal must have a plan. When things aren't going our way, we don't need to smile to make it through. Don't give in to your desire to quit. Don't believe the lies of those who suggest success is easy. Just focus on your plan and keep chipping away at it. If the struggle slows you down, keep chipping. Pride yourself in being able to have things fall apart all around you, but somehow you still bounce back and keep chipping away at your plan. No matter how slow you may be at times, keep putting one foot in front of the other. Just don't quit. What would you think of a person who told you that they were a marathon runner and you found out that every time they would only run 5 miles and quit? Sure, they're all excited and smiling when they start. They have the right shirt, shorts, and the Nikes. They look the part. They poured on the power at the beginning of the race, and then they started hurting. They try hard to look like a successful runner, but they have never finished a race. Then they get all excited about the next marathon and sign up, only to do the same thing again. What if you found out this pattern had been going on for years? This person is a wannabe marathoner. Too often I see people get started on a goal, and because they get to a painful threshold, they look for a better path or an easier way. They never finish what they start, but they keep starting something new because there seems to be an easier way and they're struggling. It happens in business. It happens in relationships. If we want to reach the finish line of our goals, if we want to experience real success, we must accept the fact that pain is going to be a part of the process. We've all been told that you must love what you do. I'm a firm believer in that. Unfortunately, some people take that concept too literally. They think that loving what you do means always enjoying everything about what you do all the time you're doing it. That's simply unrealistic. Yes, we should love what we do, but that doesn't mean the goal we are pursuing is necessarily wrong if we experience a lot of pain while doing it. We should never automatically conclude that we need to switch gears because the process seems too painful. Consider the biggest, most successful businesses and professionals you know. I guarantee they've struggled along the way, and they've probably been at it for years. Every athlete has pushed to be better and reach personal goals. Look at people who have been married for decades. They enjoy and love each other. But has it ever been painful? No question about it. It's the overall love that causes them to put one foot in front of the other during the tough times. Anybody who tells you that you can run a marathon and smile all the way is lying. Life is tough. Life's not fair. You will struggle. You'll feel pain. Just keep working your plan because it's worth it in the end. In Chapter 9, we covered, big success is never painless. Part of what makes success so rewarding is the struggle to reach your goal. Too many TV shows and books say that success in love or business is easy if you know the formula. They're wrong. This concludes Chapter 9. Chapter 10. Be prepared to abort or lose an engine. The power of negative thinking. Throughout Section 2 of this book, we spent a lot of time exposing the flaws of traditional wisdom when it comes to self-improvement behaviors and making change for the better. By now, you should understand, at least on an intellectual level, that positive thinking and irrational optimism often cause more harm than good. That's true. Ironically, though, just because someone understands the concept of the hoax of positive thinking, that doesn't necessarily mean that they understand the power of negative thinking. The thought process usually runs something like this. Okay, positive thinking won't fix things, and later in the book I'll learn strategies I can use to really overcome obstacles. Nevertheless, I should still probably try to avoid negative thoughts because they bring me down. Negative thinking can't be good. The truth is, that's wrong too. Now, it is true that negative attitudes can bring you down further, especially if you're already down. But thoughts and ideas that most people would consider negative can often be powerful and helpful. You need negative thoughts to be balanced in your life, and negative thoughts will help you along the way. One of the reasons people try to avoid negative thoughts is because they have been told that focusing on the negative will cause those negative things to happen, or you'll relive some painful experiences. And who wants to do that? it may be possible that a steadfast focus on just the negative might draw you towards spending lots of time with pessimists. But you can use thoughts about negative thinking, not negative attitudes, in order to keep bad things from happening. Negative thoughts can be tools for making good things happen. I've had a love of aviation for the time I was a little child. Most every kid from time to time dreams of being able to fly, but I had an added incentive because my family had been involved in aviation for years. Ever since I can remember, I knew I wanted to learn to fly. I've been flying now for over 20 years and have amassed numerous ratings. I am certified as an instructor for private, single-engine, and twin-engine airplanes and for helicopters. I'm certified to teach people how to fly by their instruments, and I'm even certified as a captain on Learjets. Most people with this number of certifications have military experience, but I just love flying, so I took all this training on my own. And speaking of Learjets, that's a whole different ball game. I really thought I knew how to fly until I went to Learjet school. Before stepping up into the cockpit of something as fast and sophisticated as a Learjet, most of my flying was in smaller, light, single, and multi-engine aircraft. Compared to a car, flying a plane is far more complicated, and you have to know and do many more things simultaneously. When you first tackle learning to fly, it can seem overwhelming, but even with the extra instruments, rules, and pre-flight considerations, most pilots eventually realize a level of comfort with small planes. These days, I'd even consider training for this type of aircraft to be simple. Conversely, Learjets are quite a bit more complicated and training is far more demanding. Things happen fast in a jet. Because of this, small private planes don't usually require simulator training and most people get a license with no simulator training at all. These little airplanes are forgiving enough that a flight instructor can compensate for mistakes and correct problems during an actual flight with minimal risk. If you look hard, you might be able to find a small plane flight simulator, but it's obvious that there aren't anywhere near the level of sophistication you'll find in full motion Learjet simulators. A Learjet simulator can cost between $10 million and $20 million, more than the jet itself, but the training is priceless. Power tip: our ability to handle rejection is related to our perception of how others view us. An added benefit I've realized as a result of my Learjet simulator time is that I can fly less sophisticated aircraft with even more skill and caution. The reason is because simulator training is based on what-if scenarios. What if you lose an engine? What if your engine catches fire? What if you lose cabin pressure? What if your landing gear doesn't extend? And the list goes on. By the way, these simulators are so amazingly realistic. If you just spent time learning in a simulator with professional instruction and never set foot on an actual Learjet flight deck, you could literally fly a Learjet without any additional experience. Learjet simulator training is almost never uneventful, sunny weather, problem-free aviation. As you're flying along in your full-size cockpit simulator, your instructor pushes a button behind you on a computer and all of a sudden there's smoke in the cockpit. Not a picture of smoke on your computer screen. This is the actual stuff that floats in the air and interferes with vision. If that's not exciting enough, he pushes another button and now your right engine is on fire. In a simulator, the fire isn't real, but with the smoke and the beeping and the flashing lights, the pressure to perform is real. Oh, I forgot to mention, before you took off, he pushed another button that made the weather so bad that you can barely see the runway. What will he think of next? The entire 2 weeks course is a thorough study of what makes the jet fly, everything that could possibly go wrong, and what you as a pilot must do to make it right or at least land safely under the present negative conditions. Let's discuss a few things that happen regarding negative situations. Unlike most small single and twin engine private planes, Learjets require two pilots in order to fly. Before you taxi onto the runway for takeoff, the captain, who flies from the left seat, briefs his first officer as to what action should be taken if they lose an engine by fire or some other malfunction. They go over what the response will be if various things happen at lower speeds and what other responses will be for emergencies at higher speeds. Be prepared to abort or lose an engine is always part of my pre-flight instruction. Regardless of how long a pilot has been flying, all pilots are supposed to use a checklist. The pre-takeoff checklist for smaller aircraft isn't quite as lengthy as a Learjet checklist, but it still applies. When I'm flying a smaller, light single engine or twin, the first thing I say while on the runway before I add power for takeoff is, be prepared to abort or lose an engine. I always say it out loud, even if I'm the only one in the plane. Imagine the reaction I used to get from passengers who didn't know me well and were flying with me for the first time. These days I explain the be prepared concept before we board in order to avoid the potential panic of people who don't think like I do, or I just whisper it to my co-pilot. To the uninitiated who have always been taught to use positive thinking, my statement may seem quite negative. But think about it. Who would you rather fly with? A pilot who has dealt with many simulated engine failures, or a pilot who has never practiced one? Using logic as your measuring rod, would you judge my statement, be prepared to abort or lose an engine, to be negative or realistic? Who in their right mind would challenge this and say it's negative? If it makes sense to think this way when flying an airplane with hundreds of lives on board, wouldn't it make sense to fly this way in life? By saying out loud, be prepared to abort or lose an engine, it establishes in me a mindset that, yes, there is a degree of risk involved here, and I need to stay very focused. It works. In fact, if there's a big enough problem, negative thinking can save your life. Some time ago, I was on the way to the Caribbean, and I rolled onto runway 5 and waited to receive clearance to take off. Once the air traffic controller gave me permission to take off, I acknowledged his transmission, said out loud, be prepared to abort or lose an engine, added power, and started my acceleration roll. Almost immediately, some of my gauges indicated that something wasn't quite right. After noticing the problem, I reacted and aborted the takeoff. And all that happened within 2 seconds. It didn't take long for me to discover that the malfunction my gauges had indicated was nothing very serious. A very small piece of dirt was in one of my fuel injection lines. Ultimately, the problem was quite small, and airplanes have enough redundant systems that I was never in any real danger. The important thing to remember is that I didn't know the severity of my problem, and because of my negative thinking, I was prepared to abort or lose an engine and was able to react rapidly in just 2 seconds. I remember flying with another pilot with whom I have never flown, and we were in the airplane. He let me take the position of pilot in command, PIC, so I was seated on the left. Just before takeoff, I said out loud, be prepared to abort or lose an engine. As the plane began to roll down the runway, he looked over to me and said, that's ridiculous. Nothing is going to happen. Talk about negative thinking. That's not only negative, it's plain stupid. So in order to use your newfound awareness of the power of negative thoughts, you'll need to practice analyzing statements, thoughts or ideas that appear to be negative. You'll need to be able to decide if your negative thought is a step in logical, practical planning, or if it's a statement of defeat before the fact. Planning for situations where bad things might happen is smart. Assuming defeat before you start is deadly. It's the difference between planning on failure or simply planning for problems. A good sales professional understands that an important part of pre-sales rehearsal is practicing overcoming objections of potential customers. It's not really practicing for failure, it's practicing for negative responses and determining in advance how to react to negative circumstances. Or better yet, it's planning how to avoid as many negative circumstances as possible before they happen. In many cases, simply planning for the negative helps you avoid problems in the first place. So take a minute to think about negative thoughts that might be helpful to use in your own life. Are there things in your life that you believe are negative thoughts you avoid because they might generate bad outcomes or they might make you focus on the negative? They come in all shapes and sizes, and they cover professional and personal topics. If you're in sales or marketing, have you got a plan B for your current plan A? Do you know what you would do if your current plan doesn't work? If you're dealing with a personal relationship, or you wish you had a personal relationship to deal with, have you avoided a confrontation or avoided asking someone out because you don't know what you would do if you were rejected? It might help if you put your thumb right below this paragraph, close the book, and spend a couple minutes considering negative thoughts that you've been avoiding. Just imagine how empowered you'd be if you had a plan dealing with all the negative things that might happen. Now, I'm not going to get you admitting a bunch of negative thoughts and just leave you hanging. Recognizing negative thoughts is the first part of the equation. For negative thoughts to be a powerful tool, you'll need to know as many answers as possible to the question, what would I do if this negative thing happens? My statement, be prepared to abort or lose an engine, doesn't work if you don't know how to abort or how to deal with an engine flameout. Simply admitting potential problems isn't enough. Lots of practice and awareness of answers is equally important. Admitting that I might need to implement an emergency plan is the powerful negative thought that keeps me sharp and ready to spring into responsive action. I'll tell you something that I find amazing. A few paragraphs ago, when I gave the example of a sales professional practicing overcoming objections, most everyone who has taken any kind of sales training was smiling to themselves because they know exactly what I'm talking about. Yet sales trainers and managers in some well-known global corporations, companies that are recognized for their sales teams, get out on the road with a fresh trainee and say, just imagine yourself closing the deal and don't think about rejection or it will kill you. Wow, I guess that means it's okay to imagine you'll be rejected when you're role-playing and just overcoming objections with your sales teammates, but when you meet with actual customers in the real world, you're not supposed to entertain the thought of any kind of rejection? It's like you're supposed to turn off that thought process just before you knock on the door or make that phone call. I'm sure that some people reading this book feel like they completely understand the concept of using negative statements to spark the thinking process in order to prepare for less than perfect outcomes. In my live seminars, I read the expressions of my audiences, and I can just tell some folks think that they get it already. I talked with one of these folks at a break during a presentation once, and he said, "I understand what you mean about the power of negative thinking, but I still like to think positive about things that have neutral meaning. If you have a choice about how to look at something as an optimist, I prefer to think positively about things." He continued, "I'm really a glass half full kind of guy." I said, "I'm not. While I do consider myself an optimist, I'm not a glass half full optimist. I'm a realist first and an optimist second, and I'll tell you what I mean. As I was looking for ways to get out of my depression and move on, I started getting into some of these motivational books. I wasn't impressed. In fact, it just didn't seem to be realistic or reasonable to simply avoid negative thinking. You're led to believe that if you are a positive person, the glass is half full, and if you are negative, the glass is half empty. So does that mean if I walk around with my head down and say, the glass is half empty, the glass is half empty, that I'm going to be negative? If that's true, then if I walk around in a depressed state and say, the glass is half full, the glass is half full, I'll be a more positive person. That's ridiculous. Besides, the liquid in the glass doesn't change. Let's look at this in the real world. If you give me an empty glass and I fill it up halfway, as far as I'm concerned, the glass is half full. If I fill the glass up with water and drink half of it, it's half empty. A fact-based interpretation doesn't need to be positive or negative, it's just a description. In his book, How to Get Rich, Donald Trump relates how, in the early 1990s, he lost focus, and when the market crashed, he was in the hole to the tune of $9.2 billion. He passed a beggar on the street and realized that the beggar was worth $9.2 billion more than he was. It's a great story because it makes us laugh to think that someone who is unemployed and homeless might be worth billions more than Mr. Trump. The point to take from this is that Donald Trump looked at the negative thought as a simple statement of fact and didn't quit there. His negative thought never became a negative attitude. Certainly you've heard of Donald Trump. Obviously, he persevered. So practicing for possible negative circumstances helps you move forward, but in using negative thoughts, you can't always practice for every eventuality. Because you can't plan for everything, you'll need to at least be open to the fact that because of all your training and planning, you will usually be able to come up with the answers you need. One of the leading causes in accidents in aviation today is fuel starvation. It's a typical scenario of poor fuel management. It happened to me as a young pilot. Many years ago, when I was still inexperienced, my uncle was interested in purchasing an airplane. My uncle lived in Jamaica and wanted me to fly the airplane that he was interested in buying so he could see it. That was my longest trip ever at that time, not to mention that this plane was an airplane that I had never flown before. That, coupled with flying hundreds of miles over the ocean for the first time, resulted in a real personal challenge. I left for Jamaica early one morning and finally made it at the end of the day, and it was an uneventful flight. My departure was planned a few days later. This leg of the trip turned out to be a bit more exciting, though. Due to my lack of experience, the long over-the-ocean flight plan, and navigating with only a compass, I was starting to run very low on fuel. The airplane was so low that the needles on the fuel gauge were bouncing off the left side where the E is. That little E means a lot more at 10,000 feet over the ocean than it does behind the wheel of a car, so obviously I was scared and nervous. Everywhere I looked was ocean with no land in sight. After a few minutes of staring at the E and looking outside, it felt like an eternity, I spotted a very small island. I was able to contact an aircraft controller and made him aware of my problems and told him that I could see that there was a small runway available. He radioed back that there was no fuel on the island and I shouldn't bother. He thought the lack of fuel on the island presented a problem for me. Not really. I basically had two choices, land in the water or on a runway without fuel. I may have been inexperienced, but I did still have some common sense. I chose to land on a runway without available fuel. And the funny part is that the island is called Dead Man's Key. Really. In the end, I was able to locate a little gas on the island and I got the plane home, but that was a lesson that I've never forgotten. Now, with much more experience under my belt, as I fly, I look at my fuel gauge and the needle is in the middle. Is the fuel half full or half empty? Let me tell you, it's half empty and there's nothing negative about it. Nothing. I'm amazed how many people have such an unbalanced view about this negative, positive thinking stuff. People think because I teach personal growth, I must be the world's greatest hypocrite when I tell them that something doesn't look like it's going to work or that things need to improve or heads will roll. Oh, be positive, they tell me. I am positive. I'm positive that I'm prepared to abort or lose an engine. Now that I've had to make so many aborts and lost so many engines, not in my planes, but in my professional and personal life, I'm constantly preparing for them. The many deaths of loved ones I've experienced has given me a different perspective of things that happen in my day-to-day life. In Chapter 5, we covered how trying to move on too soon frequently doesn't work. You usually need to experience the pain of negative situations before you can move past them and to the next level in your life. From that realization, you can glean another truly powerful strategy. You don't need to wait until a particular negative thing happens to experience the power that can come from that negative thought. In Chapter 5, we discussed how negative life experiences can help you change and improve your attitudes and behaviors once you have reached a point where the negative experience moves from being an emotional problem to becoming simply a life experience that provides helpful information in retrospect. Even if some negative emotions remain, when you reach a point where the negative emotions are no longer overwhelming, then logical interpretation of those experiences can be a tool you can use in moving forward. The death of a loved one or loss of a spouse can be an overwhelming, negative, and powerful experience. As we mentioned in Chapter 5, it's okay to grieve and even cry for a while. Those things are part of the process of recognizing the loss and moving on. And consider your behavior following that kind of tragic event. You're kinder to others. You think about more deep spiritual things. You regret things you didn't do while your loved one was alive. you think of happy times and it makes you smile. All these powerful negative emotions will eventually lead to your new enlightened perspective if you allow it, and hopefully you will grow as a result. Unless you're in the middle of recovering from a recent tragic loss, you can probably look at this clinically and agree that after overcoming this kind of loss, you're at least somewhat more aware of the value of people and things in your life. But imagine if you had the power to have one more chance whenever something tragic in your life happened. Don't you think your attitude about that person would be more forgiving and appreciative? You don't have to wait for something tragic, something bad, something negative to happen in order to prepare for that negative thing. In the case of being prepared to abort or lose an engine when flying, you can plan for trouble and have life-saving measures ready to go. You can do the same in business so you're ready for the eventualities that may present themselves. Finally, you can do the exact same kind of preparation in life. And in any of these cases, planning for the possibility of bad or negative things is a course of action that can yield great results even if the bad things don't come to pass. There's a hidden treasure in this approach when it comes to interpersonal relationships. If you imagine what it would be like to lose a loved one or become tragically hurt in an accident, if you live life as though you've been given a second chance, you will squeeze every ounce of good from every minute you're alive. I know you've heard someone on the news or in a book relate a near-death experience where they almost died or even clinically dead and then regained consciousness. Maybe you've heard of someone who experienced the shared joy of finding a lost loved one. In both of these examples, you'll hear the involved people relate how they cherish every living moment now. Their lives are richer. Their appreciation for the second chance is incredible, and their perspective of the gift of life is amazingly powerful. I don't suggest that you meditate deeply and daily as though you actually did lose someone before they're gone. Just consider it. Imagine the emotions surrounding how you would feel. Then consider how you would behave differently when they were gone. Or better yet, consider how you would appreciate them so much more if you had a second chance. I assure you that you would be a far more caring, considerate, appreciative, well-rounded person if you begin to seek all that life has to offer. Just because people seem to be able to understand this concept as it applies to interpersonal relationships, that doesn't mean you can't do similar things in business. While using your imagination to prepare for negative things that might occur in your business, you might just invent a whole new business strategy that changes your professional life. Even if the negative thing doesn't happen, something good might come from the negative planning. Imagine if you were in a company that depended on one or two major clients for the majority of your income. It would be smart to plan for the possibility that you might lose that client, even if it's not likely to happen. While most people would agree that not planning for this kind of eventuality is irresponsible management, very few companies or professionals bother planning for the negative until the writing is on the wall. In business, one of the really great things that comes from this kind of thinking is leverage. If you are a company who relies on a few major clients, those clients can use the knowledge of their importance to get you to lower your price or do more for less if you don't lose their account. If you have a plan of action already for when they are no longer a client, you have the leverage. What's the more, your safety net plans could just evolve into a new branch of your company. On the individual professional level, keeping your options open can improve your attitude and your income, or both. I know a person who generally hated his job, not because it was all that difficult or it didn't pay well. It was relatively easy and paid great. He just didn't like his job because he had been there for years. He was unfulfilled and generally bored. Friends and family all thought he was successful and his income was quite good, yet he didn't like his job and he started looking at other positions in the classifieds. He was even more considering moving. Neither he nor his wife wanted to move, and he considered a pay cut just to do something he enjoyed more. After a little coaching, he discovered that he enjoyed artwork and he wanted a job that would let him do more of that kind of artwork he liked to do. Instead of taking a pay cut or an uncertain job or moving, he agreed to try simply following his art interests on the weekends by participating in shows. Additionally, he agreed to stop looking for just any new job and agreed to stay in his current position until something truly great presented itself. After changing his view that he needed to get out of this current job so that he could be fulfilled and agreeing to seek fulfillment on the weekends through his art, all kinds of things changed for the better. He received a few unsolicited offers for employment and decided that where he was already working offered the best possible balance of income, requirements, location, etc. He continued to be happier and more fulfilled by working on his art during the evenings and weekends, and his current job got even better over time. The really great thing was that because he was happier, he did better at work, he got raises and more interesting responsibilities, and ended up liking his daily job even more. In this case, it wasn't the job that was the problem, it was his negative attitude. And when he began to research alternatives to what he thought was the source of his negative situation, he was able to see a whole host of activities he could use in various ways to improve his current position. There may come a time in the near future when he gets a terrific offer and changes companies and moves, but it won't be because he's desperate for any change or blind to the negatives of the new opportunity. These days, he would only move if the move was upward and positive. As you're working on skills, it might help you to think about some of the negative things you already use to empower yourself. In one word, I can illustrate a way that practically everyone reading this book is already using the possibility of negative outcomes to take steps that empower themselves. The word is insurance. People buy insurance because bad things happen. In most cases, insurance is the real-world manifestation of negative thoughts and a plan to prepare for less-than-perfect outcomes. It is actually a positive plan for negative possibilities. Attitude, not words. Consider another empowering behavior that emerges from negative thoughts. When a mother is putting a child in a car, it's considered normal for her to remind the child to put on her seatbelt. If her daughter asks, "Why, Mommy?" you can already hear the response. It's to keep you safe in case we have an accident. We don't view the mother's statement as grossly negative or morbid, so why should we with other things? Do you believe that the mother's recognition of the possibility of an accident is more likely to cause her to focus on the negative and cause her to have an accident? Ironically, most people would think her irresponsible if she didn't plan for the negative. In fact, as a society, we are so adamant about this belief that it's illegal in most states to have an unrestrained minor in a moving car. When it comes down to handling negative thoughts and using them as empowering tools, it's important to be as clinical as possible in your view of those thoughts. I'm detached from negative emotions when I say to my co-pilot, "Be prepared to abort or lose an engine." The mother explains to her child in a factual manner why the seatbelt is necessary. There's no reason to involve emotions, and it might even frighten the child unnecessarily if she did. Chapter 11. Nothing is good or bad, but thinking makes it so. I look back now to the tremendous losses and trials that I've had in my life. The things I've lived through are a wealth of examples for my seminars and my own continual learning. One story that comes to mind is when I lived in a small 28-foot travel trailer. It was all I could afford at the time. I had one little bedroom. I'll never forget that bed. I'm over 6 foot tall, and two of my feet just hung off the end of the bed because of the limited space in my little travel trailer. And the bathroom hardly deserved the title of bathroom. It wasn't roomy, nor did it even have a bath. Practically standing room only. The trailer was so small that I used to joke that I could do everything from the bedroom. Answer the phone, answer the door, and cook a meal all from the same spot. I felt like the place was constantly caving in on me. I nearly went stir crazy. I remember this one particular night. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and I woke up because I had to go to the bathroom. It was very dark, and at least I didn't have far to walk. So while I was standing in my little excuse for a bathroom in the pitch dark, all of a sudden, I felt something soft rub against my ankle. I don't have any pets or people living with me. It scared the living daylights out of me. I was so shocked by the furry surprise at my ankle that I jumped up onto the bathroom sink, which is barely the size of a large frying pan. As I crouched on top of the sink trying to control certain body functions and wishing I hadn't had so much to drink before bed, I somehow found the light switch and flipped it to reveal the source of my predicament. And by the way, my little bathroom seemed a whole lot bigger when the ordeal was over and things had to be cleaned up. An opossum had crawled through a hole in the bottom of the trailer into the bathroom. If you know anything about a opossum, they're not the fastest moving creatures and they can be pretty fearless. He didn't seem to want to leave, and they do look ugly when those teeth show. So here I am on top of the bathroom sink, and I needed to shoo him out back through his little hole. I remembered I had a broom in the tiny closet in my little bathroom. I didn't have to go too far to get it. I thought all I had to do was lean over to the closet while still on the sink. You wouldn't think that would be hard in the tiny bathroom I described, but it was an especially complicated maneuver because of my present urgent condition. One of my hands was already occupied. Needless to say, I finally figured out how to stay in my unique position and get a hold of the broom and escort my night visitor back through his little hole at the bottom of the trailer. Power tip. Imagine what you could have, what you could do, and most importantly, how you would feel if you had no psychological limitations. It didn't take an opossum for me to realize that living in a 28-foot trailer was not a good and enjoyable thing to me, and it got even worse before it got better. I remarried, and then my bachelor trailer was a family trailer. It was a challenge enough for one, much less adding another human. I was already frustrated and cramped, and now I had inflicted this little space on my new wife. Newlyweds are forgiving, and my wife was great about it, but my attitude in general was constantly pounded by my little trailer. I was in the need of a great escape. My wife's grandparents offered us a tremendous, timely gift. My wife wanted to visit the Orient, and they offered to pay for a vacation for two. It seemed like this would be exactly what we both needed. Let me pause here to emphasize the word seemed. Power tip. For every positive thing you experience in life, there are a million other people experiencing the same thing and hating it. We flew from Florida to California, then we spent hours and hours flying to Hong Kong. I guess it was a good thing I was used to being in small places. Our time there was an incredible culture shock, and to top things off, I had some pretty bad rough health problems at that time. Another challenge was that I was on a very strict diet. The saying in Hong Kong is that if it moves, crawls, or walks, they eat it. I didn't. Then there was an incredible communication barrier. Next, we were off to Taiwan. Wow, they literally have more motorcycles than they do people. I hadn't spent much time in big cities and I grew up in Jamaica, so I guess I was a little bit more sensitive to the pollution than the locals. In retrospect, the trip was amazing and experiencing the different cultures was thrilling for my wife. But because of my state of mind, the trip was awful. It seemed that wherever we went, whatever we did, my wife found the silver lining and I got stuck in the cloud. I didn't like the trip and I just wanted to get back. Even that was challenging and seemed to take even more out of me. First, we flew to Japan, then back to California, and over 24 hours later, I came home to this awesome little 28-foot travel trailer. Then it was home sweet home for me. I learned a very important lesson when I got back to my little trailer in the wee morning hours. To this day, it has changed the way I think. I knew it logically, but not emotionally. It's called perception. The length of time away and the difficulties that I experienced while gone for nearly 2 weeks made an indelible impression on my mind. These things, which I considered negative experiences, changed my perception. I remember how I felt so much relief coming home to my little 28-foot trailer. Now, I understand that perception didn't change my circumstances, but circumstances changed my perception. That realization has helped me appreciate what I already had, no matter how little it was at the time. The next two places we moved after the trailer weren't much better, so my overseas trip helped me look at things much differently. The key is to take an experience like this and try to use the foundational principles in the other areas of life and business where they might apply. Initially, I didn't like my little trailer, but my two-week adventure was such a negative experience for me that I loved the place. Conversely, my wife had always wanted to take a trip like that, so she really enjoyed the experience overall. We took the same trip and came back to the same trailer, but we had different experiences. Shakespeare said it best. Nothing is good or bad, but thinking makes it so. What a powerful statement. I've shared this in person with some people who don't quite understand it. They think that any bad circumstance, like taking drugs or choosing a life of crime or even murder, could very well be a good thing if you compare it to something worse. It's as if they're saying, look at the bright side, things could be worse. Both of these simplifications miss the point because they take the meaning as things could be worse. Using that logic, people could justify criminal behavior or any self-destructive behavior instead of confronting current circumstances in a neutral fashion and developing a plan to forge ahead. I have found it far more powerful to use my realization so I can say in a clinical, unemotional way, this is how things are for now. The statement, nothing is good or bad, but thinking makes it so, encourages us to understand how we view things is simply a perception. Additionally, we can come to understand that our perceptions are a choice, often not consciously planned, which are influenced by our culture, teachers, religion, parents, and the like. One of my favorite truths about perception is characterized in my statement, for every positive thing you experience in your life, there are a million other people experiencing the exact same thing and hating it. It also holds true that for every negative thing that you experience, there are a million other people experiencing the exact same thing and loving it. Maybe you're thinking, what's the harm in looking at the bright side of your present circumstances? Probably nothing. Usually, that's an okay approach, but the problem is when things really hit the fan, hard. When that happens, thinking positive is a lot easier said than done. You need the more clinical approach when you can't look at the brighter side. There's a time between when something negative happens and when you can look at the bright side. We need to figure out how we can cope or make life better in those middle tough times. For example, let's say you lose your very last $10,000 in some type of legitimate investment. The moment you find out you've lost it, do you say, with a big smile, wow, it could have been worse. At least I didn't lose $20,000. Not if that's your last $10,000, at least not in the real world for most people. Maybe later you can look at the bright side of your loss, but usually not immediately while you're living through and feeling the initial negative emotions. Now, I'm not suggesting that it's always possible, but consider this. What if you could simply look at the bright side? What if you could speed up the time you experience negative emotions? Would that change your life for the better? I recall flying to the Caribbean for a 4-day getaway. The island we visited was very small and the airport was very primitive. We had rented a pickup truck, and as I was driving the short distance to the airport, it started to rain. There were only two of us in the truck, and the back was full of luggage that belonged to half a dozen friends. I was going to pick everyone up after I had loaded the luggage onto the airplane. So as it started to rain, I started to speed up and quickly put everything in the plane. It kept raining, and it got harder and harder. The impending weather delay meant that if we didn't take off at a prescribed time, according to our file fly plan, the plan itself, plus paperwork and reporting the U.S. Customs, would all need to be redone. This can mean hours of delays when traveling from a third world country. As flight time was approaching, it kept raining hard. Now we had to rush back to get everyone, which meant they were going to be soaking wet. They had to ride in the back of an open pickup. My soaked friend still had to clear customs before we left, and the inside of the plane was going to be sloppy, wet, and uncomfortable for everyone. I was really getting angry. I needed to mentally change gears, or this emotion would take me over. As I was on my way back to get everyone, I mentally took a pit stop. Here's what came to mind. For every positive thing you experience in your life, there are a million other people experiencing the exact same thing and hating it. For every negative thing you experience, there are a million other people experiencing the exact same thing and loving it. Then I thought to myself, I'm sure if I asked them, most people would give anything to have their own private airplane fly to a private island and would love having it rain on them. Given the option to stay home and watch TV versus flying myself and a few friends to a long weekend island getaway, I would take the island anytime. In this case, I was able to look at the bright side of circumstances, but I didn't simply change my mind by thinking I should look at the bright side. I started by thinking about perceptions. My understanding of my bad mood being based on a perception and my realization that nothing is good or bad, but thinking makes it so, allowed me to look on the bright side. There's a slight but critical distinction that comes from the initial steps you take when analyzing a situation like this. Start by looking at your perceptions first. This is the end of CD 3.